The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern, continuing the final farewell month of this program with an encore broadcast of 9/11 terror coverage from our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek On Air show on the eve of another 9/11 anniversary. And as the spread of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq provokes emotional calls to take revenge for American beheadings, with then-co-host Warren Levinson of Associated Press.
Digging out, fighting back, inside the investigation and the politics of retaliation and stepped-up protection.
Treating the trauma, not just the survivors in New York and Washington, but the national psyche, and what to tell the kids.
Radical Islam and intelligence, and how the latter must change to successfully counter the former.
Can Wall Street be Wall Street, and the attack's economic fallout? Out at home and abroad.
America and the world. What the attack means for the larger international community and the United States' role in it.
Plus the poignant quotes and views from last week's news.
For Your Ears Only, for the week of September 7th and another 9/11 anniversary, I'm David Alpern with Warren Levinson of Associated Press and the only story that really mattered for our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek On Air show, America Attacked.
I was on the street and everyone started running and screaming away from the World Trade Towers. And then the second one, I just heard a big explosion. It moved everything and it blew our windows out.
It was more than chaotic. People were slamming into each other, trying to grapple or something to get out of the building. People did not know which way to run.
This conflict was begun on the timing and terms of others. It will end in a way and at an hour of our choosing.
No words can do real justice to the horror and pain unleashed by four teams of suicide plane hijackers last week, virtually atomizing New York's towering World Trade Center, both an icon and a functioning heart of Western capitalism, and smashing into the headquarters of American military might. Nearly 5,000 people were presumed dead, and the nation left behind seemed likely to be changed forever by the tragic loss, by new waves of security restraints and economic costs, and by a sudden painful realization of vulnerability.
But unity and heroism also emerged from the passengers who fought the captors on one hijacked plane and downed it before it reached another presumed target in Washington, to rescue workers who were themselves crushed by the falling Trade Center towers, to the endless streams of volunteers at New York's Ground Zero, blood donors coast to coast, and all those who set out flags and candles and prayed.
For more on the worst attack ever on American soil and the nation's response, we start with Newsweek Assistant Managing Editor Evan Thomas and Chief Political Correspondent Howard Fineman. But first, a few of your views in a new Newsweek poll. 71% favor attacking terrorist bases and nations that harbor them, even with a high likelihood of civilian casualties. 54% favor attacking suspected terrorists like Osama bin Laden, even if we're not sure they're responsible for last week's acts. And even though less than half think such steps would really be very effective in preventing future attacks, indeed 43% say such attacks on the U.S. are very likely, another 39% say somewhat. President Bush's job approval rating has jumped to 82%, though, almost the same as for FDR after Pearl Harbor.
Now to Evan Thomas. Evan, what do we know about what officials fear about the possibility that there could be other cells like this one out there?
Well, they fear it. One senior intelligence official told us that there could be 50 other cells out there. Another talked in terms of dozens, but they have a real fear that there's more to come.
In retrospect, court papers show a lot of terror suspects taking flight training here, but you say the new targets may be far removed from air travel.
Well, I mean, this may be fighting the last war. I mean, they found a way to use our technology against us through these through using airliners as bombs, basically. But we're going to look for other means. We know they're trying to buy uranium, enriched uranium, to build a nuclear weapon or buy a nuclear weapon. I'm sure they're looking for other weapons of mass destruction. So we have terrible things to look forward to, I'm afraid.
69% of the Newsweek poll say the FBI and CIA deserve at least some blame for last week's attack. Only 28% have a very favorable opinion of the CIA, only 37% for the FBI. What kind of official criticism or shakeup might we expect?
There's going to be a blame game, absolutely. In fact, Newsweek has learned that at the CIA, when they looked at the list of the 19 dead hijackers, they saw three names that were familiar and, in fact, had warned the INS and the FBI in late August to be watching for a couple of them. The FBI couldn't find them. At least one of them was connected to the bombing of the USS Cole. in October of 2000. So there's going to be great recrimination over just that, over not the inability to find two or three of these guys who are out there and known to be dangerous.
Newsweek's Evan Thomas. Next up, Howard Fineman. Howard, how do we judge Bush's handling of the crisis so far?
Well, the American people judge it very favorably, as you said in the poll, and I think even people in Washington who might have otherwise been critical of him toward the beginning of the week, when he was literally on the run that first day for security reasons, have had nothing but praise for him ever since.
You got the insight into a special meeting he had with the legislators?
He had a meeting on Thursday, day three of the New World, with four senators, the two from New York and the two from Virginia, and they weren't expecting much. The New Yorkers were there to plead their case for $20 billion in aid, which they didn't think they would get the president's support for, at least all that money initially. The Virginians were there because they wanted some inside dope on what was going to happen militarily and take the measure of their commander-in-chief, since Virginia is the home of the military, really, in America, plus the Pentagon. But all four of them got more than they bargained for. Instead of just a short meeting, Bush lingered with them for more than a half hour. He was very impressive to all four of them. Very warm and fraternal with Hillary Rodham Clinton, of all people, and Chuck Schumer, two Democrats from a liberal state. He immediately agreed to back the $20 billion, which surprised them, and which the Congress passed unanimously the next day.
Up to $40
billion. Up to $40 billion. And for the Virginians, there was a lot of warlike talk, including this priceless quote from the president. He said that when I take action, quote, I'm not going to fire a $2 million missile at a $10 empty tent and hit a camel in the butt. It's not going to be decisive. Now, that's not Winston Churchill, guys, but that's George Bush talking, and it's something the American people very much want to hear.
2 weeks ago, we were talking a tremendous amount about all of the fighting over the Social Security lockbox, a debate that seems to have evaporated. Do the debates over military spending evaporate as well?
I think for now, I don't think George Bush is going to push his missile defense shield right this minute. There are much more immediate concerns having to do with troop deployments and hardening of the infrastructure of the country. Homeland defense has become the new buzz phrase here in Washington. You know, George Bush campaigned to Washington promising to set a new tone here. Sadly, it took an unspeakable tragedy to change things here, but they changed utterly overnight. You know, mortal enemies literally embracing each other in tears here. All these old disputes that seem trivial now. The whole age of innuendo and gossip and scandal was blown away. And if there's anything good that came of the horrible tragedy of this week politically, it's that. And it's, of course, up to President Bush to build on the unity that's now behind him for a lot of complex decisions he's got to make now in terms of diplomacy, military affairs, and domestic affairs here, guys, because there's going to come a time when we're going to have to begin choosing between freedom and security, and those are the toughest decisions for a democracy to make.
Is there a new sense of vulnerability in Washington, as we have to say there is here in New York?
No question, David. People look up at the skies when they see an airplane fly by in the way they hadn't just a few days ago. Things are changed here forever. This was supposed to be a cushy and invulnerable place. It'll never be that again.
Howard Fineman is Newsweek's chief political correspondent. He's in Washington, as is assistant managing editor Evan Thomas.
Here are some quotes from the tragedy. "I just cried," was Won Young Kim, the Columbia University scientist in charge of monitoring earthquakes in North America, as his seismographs registered the World Trade Center buildings collapsed while he watched on TV.
Here's another one. "I don't think I'm going to get out. You've been a really good friend." That was a final email from a Trade Center employee.
"Where did it go? Oh, Lord, where did it go?" was an elderly woman in Lower Manhattan as smoke cleared, revealing empty space where towers had stood.
From our September 16, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast, now a quote from last week's news. "We're better off with a president who doesn't have a good strategy and knows he doesn't than with a president who has a bad strategy but thinks he has a good one." That was conservative talking head Newt Gingrich defending President Obama against GOP criticism. He's not taken stronger action against the brutal Islamic State. Later, the U.S. and allies, including Britain and France, agreed on an international military coalition to fight the growing radical threat. Also last week, while a ceasefire was negotiated for the embattled pro-Moscow region of Ukraine, NATO leaders authorized a rapid response force and preset bases to deter Moscow moves on member nations, which do not include Ukraine. Next, security and psychology, for your ears only.
For Your Ears Only, I'm David Alpern, back with Warren Levinson of AP and more coverage of the 9/11 terror attack from our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast.
I don't know what's happening to her. She left for work, and that's the last I've seen of her. I just want her to come home.
All I can do is pray that she comes out of this, and then I can hold her again.
Lalith Bourbon and David Vincent searching for relatives at the smoking, jutting, twisted remains of the World Trade Center. They themselves are also victims, of course, as is a whole country that suddenly feels both shocking loss and unprecedented vulnerability. To talk more about security and psychology in the aftermath of last week's terror attack, we have Newsweek's senior editor Sharon Begley, our science editor, and Dr. Peter Stavanoa, neuropsychologist at Children's Medical Center in Dallas.
But first, more of your views in the new Newsweek poll. Only 36% say they don't feel at all less safe than before, 12% say a lot less, 24% somewhat, 27% a little less safe. 43% see more terrorist attacks very likely. Only 15% strongly favor more government monitoring of private calls and emails.
Now to Sharon Begley. Sharon, beyond the restrictions at the airports that have already been announced, what new security measures do your sources see as most likely in the near future?
Well, the first round of them clearly has to do with the security breaches that are so apparent at airports. Time and again, when federal agents have run tests, they have been able to, for instance, slip past security with weapons. They've been able to get out onto the tarmac and have unrestricted access to airplanes and have put on to the planes fake pipe bombs. They've been able to follow documented bona fide workers through doors that require card access simply by piggybacking on the person who has opened it. Ground workers, caterers, custodians are subject to virtually no background or criminal check, certainly no fingerprinting. A lot of the things that we have taken for granted in a free and open society are clearly going to change.
And what about for those of us who don't really intend to go to an airport anytime soon? What can we expect to see around workplaces, neighborhoods, public spaces?
Well, this, of course, is, you know, speaks to the point that America excels at fighting the last war. And to think that by securing our airports, we are going to prevent any further terrorism is clearly naive. People are talking about closing off airspace above sports stadiums. Border checks are going to become a lot more rigorous. After the Oklahoma City bombings and those at the American embassies in Africa, a lot more stringent policies were put into place simply for access to public buildings. Biometric checks of retinas, fingerprints, all parcels being opened. Even things like the concrete barriers and flower pots that are now standard landscaping in front of many buildings after the Oklahoma City bombings. I think you'll see a lot more surveillance cameras. There's a technology that allows cameras to scan a crowd and to match any face to a million in a database in less than a second. There's, of course, huge concerns about the privacy infiltration that imposes. But again, I think at least in the immediate aftermath of these attacks, Americans are probably going to stomach a lot more than they would have a week ago.
And what are psychologists saying about the psychic cost of all this?
Well, there are, of course, individual psychological tolls. People tell me that many, many will be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. But as a collective sort of psychological angst that the country is going through, as you noted at the top, America has basically gone through its 200-plus years of existence feeling pretty much impregnable and vulnerable thanks to two huge oceans on either side of us. Americans are not used to feeling like victims, certainly not helpless victims. The sense that we have been attacked so horribly and, at least so far, have not been able to clearly and unambiguously identify who did it, much less get back at them, is a real blow to the American psyche, which, you know, I mean, this feeling of being protected, of being secure within our borders, certainly in our heartland, has a lot to do with the American mind, with creativity, with entrepreneurial zest. All the things that we think of as quintessentially American derive in large part from our feeling of security, and that's gone.
Senior editor Sharon Begley, next to Dr. Peter Stavanoa of Children's Medical Center in Dallas. Doctor, you say that more important than what people say to their kids now is how well they listen to them. What should they be listening for?
What they need to be listening for are signs of anxiety. And so it may be in older kids, things that they're saying, things that they're trying to discuss about, trying to understand this, trying to understand who did it, why did it happen. In younger children, they really need to be more watching for signs of anxiety. So it might be kids who are regressing a little bit into some old patterns of anxiety. They don't want to sleep alone. They want to, you know, not go to bed. They don't want to separate from parents. kind of typical signs that kids are really struggling and feeling insecure and somewhat out of control.
And what do you do with a kid who regresses?
You know, number one is to reassure them. You know, what parents need to be doing is being calm themselves, because you sure don't want to communicate a sense to your child that I'm out of control or that I'm highly anxious. I think that there are ways to discuss the recent disasters in such a way as to let kids know that things are stable, things are secure. And so you try to stick to a pretty predictable routine. You try to go through the motions and keep life as typical as possible, because kids really do find a lot of security in what is consistent and familiar to them.
I heard a mother recently complaining or worrying that her little boy, having seen the crash of the plane on television, kept crashing his toy plane into a play building over and over. She was really worried about this, but experts said that it was his way, a normal way of regaining control, in a way, of what he'd witnessed.
Exactly. What that does is, for a child, that puts the control back in their hands. And so now this occurrence that he's watching happen over and over and over, he's in control of that occurrence. And so now the outcome is dependent on him. And so that's no different than a little boy or a little girl who plays a superhero, and they work miracles as a superhero, putting things back in control for them so that it gives them that sense of security.
Should we be regulating how much the kids see and read about this?
Absolutely. I think that particularly for younger kids, they really don't need to know a lot about this. I think that they're going to stumble upon some information. Peers are going to be telling them things, and so parents may find themselves having to fill in gaps, and they certainly don't want their kids going on rumors and speculation, so they're going to have to correct some factual information for them. With older kids, I also think it's a good idea to limit access to some extent, but clearly these kids have the means of, you know, reading the paper, watching television. You just don't want them to be consumed by it. And so I would recommend that parents keep an eye on what their kids know and try to enter into discussion and use this as an opportunity to talk about the family's values and what the family's kind of collective response is to the disaster.
And how do parents explain it to older kids anyway, the evil of the act as well as the pain and the loss, then deal with their own kids' anger or fear?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as adults we're struggling with the very same issues, and I think that there's, you know, I think as adults we can acknowledge that to our kids, but at the same time we also have to reestablish that there is a line of trust here. And so while this kind of thing does occur, and you can kind of put it into your family's value system in terms of political values or faith-based values in terms of trying to discuss the evil involved, but then eventually there needs to be some line of trust where it's kids trusting parents to maintain safety, it's parents trusting the government or parents trusting God or whomever, but at some point there needs to be this sense of security so that we're not all walking around just wondering what's going to happen next.
Dr. Peter Stavanoa is a neuropsychologist at Children's Medical Center in Dallas. We also spoke with Newsweek senior editor Sharon Begley in New York.
Here's another quote. He was my angel, Norma Hessick, who worked her way down from the 82nd floor of Trade Center office after the first plane hit. She was cowering in the corner of a nearby hotel when a man said, "Lady, take my hand," and led her to a local hospital.
From our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast, now a quote from last week's news. Can we talk or grow up? Those are two trademark lines for sharp-tongued, trend-setting, frequently facelifted comedian, actress, author, and producer Joan Rivers in more than 50 years of politically incorrect cracks about celebrities, tragedies, and herself. She died last week at age 81 after outpatient surgery on her vocal cords went awry. Next from our original 9/11 coverage, Islam and Intelligence, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only from the rebroadcast of 9/11 coverage that filled all our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek on Air program. With Warren Levinson of Associated Press, I'm David Alpern.
We are, in a sense, seeing the definition of a new battlefield in the world, a 21st century battlefield. And it is a different kind of conflict.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, grim at the Pentagon. Last week's attack on America was both the greatest victory yet for Islamic extremism and the greatest failure of Western intelligence, the FBI and the CIA. To talk about both and how what some call the Third World War can best be fought, we have Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East expert Christopher Dickey and RAND Corporation Senior Fellow Bruce Hoffman, also a staff member for the 1999 report on terrorism to the President and Congress.
First, though, more of your views from the new Newsweek poll. Only 32% are very confident that local and national law enforcement can break up terror plots. 42% are somewhat confident. But Americans split 2-1 against putting Arabs and Arab Americans under special surveillance, and 50-32% against reducing ties to Israel to lessen acts of terrorism against the United States.
Now to Chris Dickey and the process that produces suicide terrorists. The guys who were involved in this had to have pilot training. They had to have been exposed to a lot of resources. This was an expensive plot to carry out. What does this tell us about how suicide terrorists are bred?
Well, I think there's an interesting complex of emotions and rationalizations at work here. I think, first of all, you have to understand that a lot of Muslims around the world feel that Muslims are on the defensive, that they're under attack. They watch the TV, and whether it's in Chechnya or Bosnia in the old days or Kashmir or Palestine, they feel that they, their life, their culture, their roots are under attack. Now, that doesn't mean anybody's going to start becoming a suicide bomber, but it lays the groundwork for the kind of grievances that can be exploited. Then some may believe that they will have a quick ticket to paradise, as the Quran suggests. And others, and I think this is very, very 21st century, I think others that we've seen in action, like Ramzi Youssef and maybe the mastermind of the Nairobi bombings, I think they want to see their name in fiery lights. I think they like their 15 minutes of horrible fame. I think there's a tremendous amount of egotism involved with a lot of these people.
Some people wondered about reports that last week suicide terrorists were seen at bars and even strip clubs before the final attack, but I heard you say during the week that that's actually part of their plan.
Well, one of the things that these terrorists are taught in the training camps of Afghanistan is to blend in with the culture around them, not to go to the mosques, not to grow beards, not to act like devout Muslims. When you have people living undercover, this sort of weird double life, as sort of secret agents for an avenging God over a period of several years, it's not surprising that they would do things like that.
That was, in fact, part of the testimony in the East Africa embassy bombing case.
How do recruits get to bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan? Whose money pays to get them there and train them?
One of the things you have to remember about bin Laden's networks is that they don't cost very much. Sometimes people take up a contribution at the local mosque to get there, to Peshawar in Pakistan and then to Afghanistan. There's not a lot of money needed for that. How do they find out about it? Well, veterans of the Afghan Arab movements during the Afghan war, just the gossip on the internet, preachers in the mosques. There's a lot of talk going around, and especially young men who are spoiling for a fight or feel that they personally want to become agents of a vengeful God find their way to those camps.
Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief Chris Dickey. Next up, RAND scholar Bruce Hoffman, who worked on one of the most recent warnings to the government about terror and talked about it with us at the end of 1999. Bruce Hoffman, you must have felt horribly vindicated in some way last week.
Well, these are exactly the kind of things you don't necessarily want to be vindicated about, but I think the fundamental message when we put together the first of the Gilmore Commission's reports was really that we had to really focus on the entire spectrum of potential terrorist attacks, not just on one particular segment or not just on one particular end of that segment, end of that spectrum. And I think that's what's being borne out for these attacks. They were certainly mass killing and widespread destruction, but they weren't with any of the exotic weapons that many commentators thought terrorists would surely unleash.
Is getting bin Laden and a few like him or something else the top priority to win this terror war?
Well, I think one has to do first things first. We have to bring to account those who perpetrated the attack. So certainly bin Laden and his organizations, if in fact they're conclusively linked, that has to be the first move.
What even if they're not? I mean, is it worth just getting rid of them finally if we could?
Well, I think this is the fundamental issue. There's not going to be any progress against terrorism as a global problem until we systematically attack, on the one hand, the root causes and what motivates people to turn to terrorism, but the other hand, neutralizing those existing groups that are committing this violence. So, yes.
What do you make of the president's statements that it's not just the terrorists that the United States will go after, but those who harbor them, which seemed in some ways a veiled reference to specific countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, and some others?
Well, I think this really harkens to the famous dictum that Mao Zedong said about gorillas of the fish swimming in a friendly sea, and that once you drain that sea, the fish can't swim anymore. So I think it's very apt and it's accurate. The sort of analogy that's drawn now is draining swamps, and it's the swamps of the renegade governments, or governments that harbor or provide sanctuary to the terrorists, and they need to be drained, otherwise the terrorists can't thrive.
Most Muslims rightly reject terrorism and complain of unwanted prejudice and suspicion against them, but some experts say they may have to go beyond that, like Japanese Americans in World War II play a key role in the war now begun, reporting suspects, turning off support, infiltrating terror cells as they are best suited to do. Or is that too Hollywood, too much to ask?
Well, I think we're getting a number of Middle Eastern and Arab states to pledge their cooperation. I think that's exactly the right way to go, that it's very hard to call on individuals to, you know, certainly there's ways that they can cooperate, but the first focus of attention has to be on getting the cooperation of governments. Then I think the governments themselves are best placed to get their citizens and their people to cooperate as well.
Terrorism expert Bruce Hoffman is director of the RAND Corporation Washington office. We also talked with Newsweek Paris Bureau Chief Chris Dickey in New York.
Here's another quote. We are all New Yorkers. That was Dominique Moisi, France's leading international scholar on the Western solidarity created by last week's attack.
From our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast. Now a quote from last week's news. If you guys do not get here, we are going to die. That was a 2012 radio message from the fatally besieged U.S. diplomatic post in Benghazi, Libya, that had American contractors in a nearby CIA annex rushing to arm themselves and roll, according to the new book 13 Hours, by five of the U.S. special ops veterans and journalism professor Mitchell Zukov. But the commandos say they were delayed a critical 20 minutes as the CIA station chief tried to prompt local militias to the rescue rather than expose an agency presence. Also last week, U.S. drone strikes killed key leaders of al-Qaeda-connected al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. Next from our 9/11 show, will Wall Street still be Wall Street? For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm David Alpern with AP's Warren Levinson and more 9/11 coverage from our September 16th, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast.
It is my hope there would not be long-term impacts. Certainly, this is a setback for the financial markets, the financial district, specific industries. But I point to the resiliency of the U.S. economy to recover from setbacks like this. We've survived a lot of things in our history, and we're going to survive this and carry on.
Alan Skranka, chief strategist for the Edward Jones Brokerage in St. Louis. Last week's sneak attack clearly bypassed the most traditional American icon, the Statue of Liberty, to take out a much larger, newer, nearby icon of the nation's economy and the world's. The destruction of the World Trade Center also paralyzed nearby Wall Street, raising serious questions about its ability to ever fully be what it was.
Experts disagree on which way the mind-boggling devastation and the plans to rebuild will tip an economy already teetering on the brink of recession. Midway Airlines quickly went out of business during the airport lockdown. The whole industry is warning of bankruptcy because of new security requirements and fear of flying. To talk more about it, we have Newsweek Wall Street editor Alan Sloan and Jim Simmons, president of SunGard Recovery Systems, which helps get businesses in crisis back up and online.
But first, more of your views from that new Newsweek poll. 63% are worried that financial and psychological fallout from the attacks will seriously hurt the U.S. economy, including 24% very worried. Somewhat fewer, about 1 in 5, are also very worried that the world economy and individual portfolios will be seriously hurt.
And now, Alan Sloan. Alan, you say that morality triumphed mammon on Wall Street last week. How so?
Because firms that normally are in each other's throats and stock exchanges who are bitter rivals all agreed to set everything aside, cooperate, and let the money go. The NASDAQ market could have been back much earlier than the New York Stock Exchange, but chose not to do it. Various firms that could have traded and left other firms at a disadvantage because, to be blunt, the people in them are largely dead. They all agreed to not trade. It was amazing. You don't see stuff like that often. In fact, I think Probably never.
You say the New York Stock Exchange itself was not really harmed. What are the big problems for what we generally think of as Wall Street?
The problems are, first of all, a lot of people are dead, and you know their firms are not functional yet. Second, there were huge problems. A lot of communication stuff was wiped out. Electricity was wiped out. Buildings were unsafe. A lot of people who survived and businesses that survived have nowhere to go, and they've got to scramble and set up. So even though the stock exchange building itself was fine, they can't operate without phones. They can't operate without mass transit to get the workers there. They can't operate without power. They can't operate without a lot of things, none of which they had.
What about the idea of Wall Street, or at least that segment of Lower Manhattan that we come to think of as Wall Street, as a physical place? I mean, basically, the financial industry has grown beyond there, especially given the prevalence of computers a lot in recent years. Does this accelerate that?
Yeah, I think what's going to happen here is two things. First, you have all these firms who have office, you know, who no longer have office space, and they've got to go somewhere, and there's not enough space, and certainly in Wall Street and probably not in New York City to accommodate them. So they're going to go other places, and even after the rebuilding is done, many of them will never come back. And also, I'm not sure how the New York Stock Exchange, which is a physical place, can dare risk being subjected to going out of business again. So I don't know what's going to happen there.
At this obviously premature point, also, how do you see the national economy being moved by the destruction, by $40 billion planned for rebuilding, recovery, reorienting security and defense capabilities? What other key factors, like Mideast oil?
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. The question is, will investor confidence collapse and people stop spending? Will the Federal Reserve cut rate cuts more and rates more than it otherwise would have, and what effect will that have? If something happens and the oil exporting countries decide to play games and oil goes to $50 a barrel, God only knows what will happen. On the other hand, you can make the case that all of this extra spending, that the $100 billion or $150 billion that the world's central banks have put into the system will help start a boom. There's absolutely no way to tell.
Wall Street editor Alan Sloan. Next up, Jim Simmons of SunGard Recovery Systems, which has 5,000 client firms and experience in 600 previous disasters. Obviously, you've never seen anything like this. What are these companies going to need?
We have handled dozens of disasters at one time before, from hurricanes, but I think the human tragedy and the fears made this one different. Because of that area of Manhattan that was affected, what we found is that the majority of firms are relocating office space, 25 to 50 people, moving them up to SunGard centers up and down the eastern seaboard, Jersey City, Boston, Philadelphia, etc., and managing their business out of there. It's not an area of Manhattan where you find huge, large data centers, but it was quite occupied with office space that people need to replicate.
You have both backup locations throughout North America and a fleet of mobile recovery facilities. What do these facilities offer?
Basically, everything a business needs to keep in business. They've got computer systems, power generation, redundant networks, access to the internet, as well as desks, chairs, phones, fax machines. 26 of those facilities around North America, and actually, we're fortunate now with 27 disasters, we're running at less than half capacity.
And in some of these cases, or in a lot of these cases, these clients have already given you backup information, data files that they can now draw back on?
Absolutely. We had a bond trading company that traded $5 billion in bonds on Thursday from our Jersey City center.
What is your experience with companies that have, for one reason or another, had to move out of their location? Do they generally come back?
I believe certainly Lower Manhattan will get rebuilt and it will still remain the financial center. It's just going to take a lot more time than the normal run-of-the-mill disaster.
Jim Simmons is president of SunGard Recovery Systems in Philadelphia. We also spoke with Newsweek Wall Street editor Alan Sloan.
And more from the news. She never sat back. That was U.S. Solicitor General Theodore B. Olson about his wife, Barbara, the lawyer and TV commentator who called him from a hijacked American Airlines jet before it crashed into the Pentagon. She asked me, what should I tell the pilot, Olson said. She was trying to do something.
He didn't appear to be a religious fanatic at all. That was Dr. Frank Ritchie, an aeronautics professor, about former student Waleed al-Sherry, one of the suspected suicide terrorists.
Now a quote from last week's news. Reckless, conscious disregard of known risks.
That was a federal judge in New Orleans holding energy giant BP primarily responsible for the 2010 Gulf oil spill, meaning up to $18 billion in new civil penalties beyond the $28 billion BP has already spent on damage claims and cleanup costs. Another federal judge last week blocked Ohio's cutback on early voting as unfairly disadvantaging minorities and the poor. And a federal appeals court in Chicago declared bans on same-sex marriage in Indiana and Wisconsin, quote, totally implausible and unconstitutional, echoing similar decisions in Oklahoma, Utah, and Virginia. Next from our September 16, 2001 broadcast, a new view of America and the world, for your ears only. Some final thoughts on 9/11 from our September 16, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast. With co-host Warren Levinson of AP, I'm David Alpern.
We call upon the entire world to step up and help, because terrorism is a common enemy to all, and we're in this together. The United States has borne the brunt, but who can be next?
Senator John Warner joining the call for a new worldwide alliance against terrorism, which even threatens old foes like Russia and China, not to mention nations throughout the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. And suddenly it seems we may need them more than we used to think they needed us. So writes Newsweek International Editions editor and columnist Fareed Zakaria, and we have him on the line now to talk more about the new world that the world, especially America, has just entered. Fareed, never mind Francis Fukuyama, you call this the end of the end of history. How so?
If you remember, about 10 years ago, people began to think that the world of politics, political struggle, ideological strife was over, that we were all going to be sitting around worried about our bonuses and consumerism and materialism. And I think what has just happened is brought back politics and government and all kinds of very old-fashioned things, because we realize that there is, at the end of the day, still government's primary task at hand, which is to ensure our security.
Well, speaking of Fukuyama, he actually considered the threat of Islamic extremism but dismissed it. What didn't he understand?
It's an interesting question. For Fukuyama, Islam didn't pose a radical political Islam, didn't pose a threat because, he said, it has no adherence in the West. In other words, we don't seek to become Islamic. There is no tussle of ideas here. The way he put it, I think, was he said, they are no threat to us. The problem is we are a threat to them, a threat they feel with blinding intensity. And that is, after all, what has motivated the struggle. So we're in a war that we may not have wanted to start, but we're in it all the same.
And how do you think this attack will revive the importance of government and politics, both here and abroad?
After having watched what happened and has happened in the last week and the extraordinary heroism of those firefighters and rescue workers and policemen, I think we're all going to have a somewhat different attitude towards the hero worship of simply making $1 million. We suddenly realize there's more to life and there are honorable and dignified professions out there. At another level, government becomes important because it is protecting us or trying to protect us from this threat.
Is there a point at which the Islamic world revolts against this in some way as well?
Oh, I think the most important thing to understand is that this is a battle within the Islamic world. That is, that there are, for the most part, within this world, moderate, secularists, liberals who believe in combining Islam with modernity, just as the West has combined Christianity with modernity. And then there is this small, fanatical minority of radical political Islam that is essentially an attempt to take the world, take their world back to the Middle Ages. And they are on the front lines of the struggle. One of our great tasks, as Warner alluded to, is to make countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia realize that if they do not help us now, they are on the front lines. So Osama bin Laden's number one target in reality is the moderate Arab regimes, because he believes they are the true infidel.
And you say even beyond those who might fear a threat of extremism, it's the end of the free ride for the rest of the world if the United States loses in this war.
Well, I think that the rest of the world has to recognize, and I think they will recognize just how much they benefited from the world, if you will, that America has helped create, a world of globalization, free trade, free travel, lots of opportunities for everybody, a world of freedom in every sense of the word. But they will have to realize that it doesn't come free, that you have to pay for it, and that you have to support political struggles, that you have to take part in the defense of this order actively. They cannot, if you will, denounce America by day and consume her bounties by night. And for the most part, we have seen a spirited response, but I think we will need much more, not just from the average American, but from the average freedom-loving person.
The talk around the United States now is of warfare in response. Do we need to think about warfare in this war in a different way from the World War II model?
It's a very different war, and others have alluded to this, but the most important thing to remember, I think, is it's a three-front war. There's a military aspect, probably the smallest, for a very simple reason. There aren't a lot of targets. There is then the intelligence, covert operation, police work aspect. That's probably the largest, and that's going to take enormous international cooperation. And then finally, there is the political. We have to wage a war politically in the way that we did against communism, to lessen its appeal, to make countries around the world not susceptible to its ideology. And similarly, we have to support moderate Islam, support moderates, so that we don't make radical Islam appealing to hundreds and thousands of people. Because if they get new recruits by the thousands every day, everything we do on the military front will be for naught.
Fareed Zakaria is editor of Newsweek International and a columnist for Newsweek magazine.
Here are more quotes from last week. "We are not interested in reading them their Miranda rights." That was Georgia's Republican Congressman Bob Barr on terrorists and those who support them. But Virginia's Republican Senator John Warner said, "It is beneath our dignity to declare war on alleged terror kingpin Osama bin Laden."
A unified Congress sings its patriotism on the Capitol steps. From our September 16, 2001 Newsweek on Air broadcast, and repeated for your ears only. For this final month, For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, Stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org. This encore broadcast was engineered in 2001 by Lance Neal and re-engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. For former co-host Warren Levinson, I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Contact me at davidearsonly@gmail.com. Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. This week last year, we considered the credibility problems surrounding President Obama's approach to the rebellion in Syria, now seen by many as a root of the ISIS crisis. From our September 8, 2013 broadcast, hosted by Catherine Herzog and me.
I don't want to take off the table an option that might or might not be available to the President of the United States to secure our country.
I think it'd be a mistake for me to jump the gun and speculate, because right now I'm working to get as much support as possible out of Congress. But I'll repeat something that I said in sweep when I was asked a similar question. I did not put this before Congress. Just as a political point or as symbolism.
Mixed signals on what to do about chemical weapons in Syria continued last week, both at home and abroad. In Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry raised the hopes of many interventionists, and the fears of a majority by refusing to rule out boots on the ground in some crises after a proposed airstrike. But President Obama at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg echoed a top aide in refusing to say he'd order military action even without the congressional approval he had sought. Indeed, his repeated answer on the question implied that he was serious about letting a dubious Congress decide.
Obama continued to argue that moral duty and protection of America's allies and homeland required military action. But his stress on measures limited in scope and time left many wondering how much any Syrian threat would really be degraded or deterred, and he won little eager support at the G20. At home, concerns about tipping the battlefield balance to Islamist rebels grew with a viral video showing one militia's brutal execution of government soldiers, though it was later revealed to be more than a year old.
The situation seemed to demonstrate the limits of U.S. influence in and understanding of the complex rivalries, new and old, in the Middle East and beyond. Those are topics recently considered by our frequent guest Michael Brenner, University of Pittsburgh professor emeritus and a fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And for your ears only, Professor Brenner is on the line again now. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, David. It's good to be back with both of you.
What deterrence on Assad chem weapons do you see from Obama's limited strike plan?
Well, much depends really on what the objective actually is. And as the lead-in indicated, the signals coming out of the White House are ambiguous. The president has said repeatedly that these would be limited, restricted in time, restricted in terms of targets, and would be designed simply to sort of punish the Assad regime for one concrete act, which is this alleged chemical weapons attack. In other words, the way it's been defined is as a sort of as much as a symbolic gesture.
Would Obama and America lose more international credibility by not striking after all his arguments, or by going ahead with limited or no effect on Assad, perhaps graphic civilian casualties, possible retaliation, and deeper U.S. involvement in the civil war?
Well, Mr. Obama, I mean, to put it candidly, he seems to have a certain genius for putting, in terms of foreign policy, of putting himself in lose-lose situations. The same was true in Afghanistan when he committed us to a major escalation while setting a fixed deadline for the withdrawal of the very troops that he was dispatching. The prevarication, the hesitation, the evident uncertainty as to what the United States wants to do as well as intends to do itself tends to sort of erode your standing and credibility. And this coming at just one other word on this, at a time when American influence over events in the region as well as over particular governments is at a low point, simply continues that slide, that downhill slide in terms of American prestige and influence.
Let me ask, given the development of death-dealing machinery since the mustard gas era of World War I, from machine guns and missiles to landmines, napalm, nuclear weapons, should we still be making such an issue of chemical weapons?
Well, logically, there's really no reason to do that. When you kill people in all kinds of gruesome ways, singling out sort of chemical weapons is sort of difficult to sustain. But since we do have these, you know, accords going back more than a century that set some kind of agreed limits on the kinds of violence that countries can use by some vague international standard, it's better to keep it in place than not. Perhaps the error, though, which the president made was when he laid down this red line, saying that if indeed that line is crossed in this particular instance, the United States committed itself to military action. And, of course, you never really want to do that because it not only limits your options, but you never know beforehand what the circumstances are going to be in which this, postulated red line might be crossed.
Well, in fact, we should note he never really said in that first instance that it was military action. He said it would change his thinking, it would cause a shift in his policy, but he never said a military strike, and it sort of has escalated in the commentary about it. But let me ask you another question. Underlying all the rhetoric about Syria's moral violations, strategic threats, seems to be concern about the larger message to, in particular, Iran and its nuclear program. How much do you think attacking Syria would affect the Tehran government?
Well, it would really place the new Tehran president, in particular, Mr. Hani, in a very ticklish situation, because clearly he would like to move towards reaching some kind of modus vivendi with the United States without totally abandoning the nuclear program, which, by the way, everybody agrees at this point, is not a weapons program per se. And ending sort of their diplomatic and economic isolation. To achieve that end, he's going to have to walk a tightrope, both in terms of Iranian politics, which, let's remember, is very complex. I mean, Iran is not a totalitarian state in which, a leader has complete freedom of action, and diplomatically. So what an attack on Syria does is play into the hands of all the hardliners opposed to any kind of accommodation with the United States. And I strongly suspect, and most people who really do know Iran much better than I do, agree that that's his main worry. In other words, it's going to be restrained in Iran's diplomacy. It may impose on them. They're taking a hard line, at least rhetorical position, but they really don't want to do anything in response. Although Syria is of some importance to them as a tactical ally, in concrete terms, it's really a secondary concern.
Michael Brenner is University of Pittsburgh Professor Emeritus and Fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
Crisis of credibility from our September 8, 2013 broadcast. While a deal backed by Moscow led to reduction of Syria's chemical weapons threat, U.S. reluctance to better arm or assist moderate Islamic rebels was later criticized by many for permitting the advance of more radical forces such as the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. But the ease with which ISIS later captured U.S. weapons from American-trained forces in Iraq made Obama's hesitance at least arguable, if increasingly less popular, especially after the ISIS beheading of two long-held U.S. journalists. Obama last week did send another 350 troops to protect Americans in Iraq, as a poll of likely voters showed 73% concerned that he has no strategy for combating ISIS. But just 30% support sending major U.S. combat forces back to Iraq, albeit up from 12% last December, and 41% remain opposed, while a sizable 29% are undecided. 63% of Americans now back military strikes against the Islamic State inside Syria, compared with virtually the same number opposing it a year ago. I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Congress sings again on the Capitol steps for last year's 9/11 anniversary.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam. God bless America, my home sweet home. God bless America, my